What happens when antibiotics don't work? Superbugs have become resistant to many antimicrobial drugs. This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
We'll hear how a researcher saved her husband's life when he developed a multi-drug resistant infection. She recruited viruses from sewage to fight the bacteria.
Bacteriophages have been used in Eastern Europe for more than a century, but they never caught on in the West.
We'll talk with the author of The Living Medicine about how a life-saving cure was nearly lost and why it might rescue us when antibiotics fail.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, phage fighters battling superbugs with nature's viral warriors.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, new research offers a wonderful excuse to eat nuts. Scientists studied more than 50,000 volunteers in the UK Biobank who filled out detailed dietary questionnaires when the study began. These people were between 40 and 70 years old and free of cognitive problems at the time. The investigators followed up between 6 and 10 years later to find out how the participants had fared. Those who ate nuts every day were 12% less likely to develop dementia during that time. Overall, 2.8% of the volunteers had a dementia diagnosis by the end of the study. Unsalted almonds and cashews appeared to be more helpful than salted or processed nuts. Women, older people, and those with healthy lifestyles seem to benefit the most.
There's growing evidence that viral infections could be contributing to dementia. One of the prime suspects is the virus responsible for cold sores, herpes simplex virus 1. After a cold sore shows up on the lips and heels, HSV-1 hibernates in a brain structure called the trigeminal ganglion. Triggers such as sun exposure, stress, or hormonal changes can activate the latent virus. When that happens, the virus can travel to the lips and up into brain tissue. There, immune cells called microglia react with inflammation. This response can persist long after the virus retreats. The investigators used a mouse model to learn where the virus travels within the brain. They discovered a number of structures are affected. This is not the first time scientists have linked HSV-1 infection to brain inflammation. This pathogen hypothesis is a different way of understanding the basis of Alzheimer's disease.
People who eat more foods rich in omega-3 fats when they're younger adults seem to have a lower likelihood of certain cancers as they grow older. That's the conclusion from a study of more than 250,000 volunteers in the UK Biobank. At the start of the study, the participants answered detailed questionnaires about their customary diets. Researchers collected health data on them over nearly 13 years, with special emphasis on cancer diagnoses. People who consumed more omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids were less likely to develop cancer overall. Several individual cancers were less probable in people eating lots of omega-6 vegetables or omega-3 fats from fish or nuts. One exception was prostate cancer, which was a bit more likely among men consuming more omega-3 fats.
Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in American men. Regional differences suggest some environmental risk factors might be responsible. Researchers at Stanford University investigated the potential role of agricultural pesticide exposure in prostate cancer incidence and mortality. They collected county-by-county data on pesticide use and compared it to data on prostate cancer diagnosis and mortality in two different groups of men. Four of the pesticides were associated with a higher risk of death due to prostate cancer. Three were herbicides, and one was an insecticide. The authors encouraged public health officials to consider environmental exposure to pesticides as a potential risk factor for prostate cancer.
People usually think of gout as a condition that affects the joints. A new study examining all the genes associated with gout has found that many of these same genes contribute to cardiovascular complications. The researchers analyzed genetic data from 2.6 million people around the world to make this discovery. However, genes are not destiny. The scientists found that lifestyle habits, including smoking, drinking alcohol, obesity, sedentary habits, and consuming highly processed foods, can exaggerate the elevated risk of both gout and cardiovascular disease. Conversely, following healthy lifestyle habits greatly reduces the risk of both conditions. According to the authors, the effect of adherence to a healthy lifestyle was greater in individuals with a higher genetic risk. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Superbugs that have developed resistance to many antibiotics are becoming more common and more worrisome.
Is there an alternative to antibiotics for treating these deadly antibiotic-resistant infections? Bacteriophage therapy has been available for over a century. Why haven't these viral warriors been utilized more effectively?
We begin today's show with an interview we recorded in 2019. Dr. Stephanie Strathdy is co-director of the University of California, San Diego Center of Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics, and co-author of a memoir, The Perfect Predator, a scientist's race to save her husband from a deadly superbug.
Dr. Strathdy, please tell us about your husband, Dr. Tom Patterson's life-threatening drug-resistant infection. We understand that happened while vacationing in Egypt several years ago.
That's right. My husband and I were on vacation, and he acquired a superbug infection. It's Acinetobacter baumannii, which is commonly referred to as Arachibacter because so many vets come back from the Middle East with this infection. And he didn't know it at first, and neither did I. He actually had a gallstone attack, and we ended up at a clinic in Luxor, and he started to really deteriorate very quickly, and we got him medevaced out of there to Germany. And that's where they realized that he had a giant pseudocyst in his abdomen the size of a small football. And inside it was lurking this organism that a couple of days later came back as Acinetobacter baumannii. And it was almost fully resistant when they diagnosed it there. But by the time he was medevaced home to San Diego, it was resistant to every antibiotic under the sun.
How was he doing? I mean, that sounds life-threatening.
Well, he was in and out of a comatose state in the beginning, but we did manage to stabilize him. And there was a question as to whether or not they were going to operate and try to remove this cyst. But when they realized that they didn't have any antibiotics to cover it and that he could, you know, die of septic shock, they decided to do a procedure with interventional radiology where they poke holes in his abdomen and basically try to siphon off the fluid with catheters. And that seemed to work for a couple of weeks. But one day, in fact, it was the day before we were supposed to get out of the hospital, he sat up in bed and one of these internal drains inside him slipped and it dumped all of that infected fluid into his abdomen. And he immediately went into septic shock right before my eyes. And rushed back to the ICU and was dying from that moment onward. It was just dreadful.
And of course, as you said, there's no antibiotic that actually can handle this infection. What did you do?
Well, my colleagues were pretty stunned when he was medevaced back to the U.S. that colistin, which is the last resort antibiotic, that this infection was already resistant to that. And when this drain slipped inside him and he became fully colonized with this bacteria, they basically said that there was nothing else that they could do.
That must have been incredibly scary.
It was just unbelievable. I remember just thinking that here I am, an infectious disease epidemiologist, and my husband is dying from what I used to consider a wimpy bacterium that I studied in undergrad days. I used to streak this bacterium on Petri dishes, and we had no, you know, protective gear required. This is basically a bacterial kleptomaniac that has stolen all of these antibiotic resistance genes over the last couple of decades, and it's now considered to be the WHO's public enemy number one in terms of superbugs.
So without an antibiotic to overcome the infection, with your husband slipping away, you had to find some other way of dealing with this infection. What did you do?
Well, he was in a coma at this time, and I didn't even know if he could hear me, but I decided that it wasn't just up to me to decide that I wanted to kind of leave no, you know, stone unturned. So this one particular day when his eyebrows were kind of, you know, just twitching a little bit, I took his hand and I said, honey, I know that you've been fighting a long time and you may want to give up. And if you want to give up, that's okay. You know, I'll let you go. But if you want to live, just, you know, please squeeze my hand and I'll do whatever I can do to find something that will overturn this. And I waited, and a few minutes later, he squeezed my hand really hard, and I just took it as a sign. So I went home and I did what any, I guess, scientist would do. I went and Googled it and said, you know, multi-drug resistant bacterial infection and alternative therapies. And using PubMed, which is the Google for Scientists version, I found a couple of papers that mentioned different types of treatments that had not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And one of these was phage therapy. And I knew what bacteriophages were because I'd studied them, you know, 30 years ago in my microbiology class.
And Dr. Strathy, what is a bacteriophage?
Well, a bacteriophage is actually a virus that has naturally evolved to attack bacteria. So they're actually the oldest and most populous organism on the planet. In a single drop of water, there can be millions or even billions of phages, and they're everywhere. They're not just in water. They're under rocks. They're in soil. They're on our skin. They're in our bodies. And if you're trying to fight a bacterial infection that's in your gut, then the best place to find the phages that attack those bacteria are in sewage. So that's actually where we found the phages that we used to treat Tom.
Well, Dr. Strathy, so you looked in sewage to find a bacteriophage that would actually be capable of combating this Acinetobacter. How successful were you?
Well, it actually wasn't me that went picking through the sewage, thank God, but I did come up with the idea, so I'll take the credit for that. But I reached out to my colleague, Dr. Chip Schooley, who was then the head of our infectious disease division, and he was also a personal friend. And I said, Chip, it sounds like you guys are giving up and that there's nothing else that you can do. I've looked into some alternative treatments. What do you think of phage therapy? And he said in an email to me, you know, what an interesting and intriguing idea, but it may be ahead of its time. But if you can find some phages that match his bacteria, I'll call the FDA and get approval for compassionate use, and we'll give it a whirl. So little did he know that it was really behind its time. Phages had been discovered 100 years ago and were being used and still are in the former Soviet Union. But I reached out to researchers all over the globe, and I found a handful that agreed to help. And one in particular at Texas A&M University agreed to be kind of the command center, where we sent him Tom's bacterial isolate, and he and his lab tested their whole library of phages and went through sewage samples to see if they could find any more that would be a precise match to the Acinetobacter baumannii infection that Tom had. We also had some help from the U.S. Navy, the Navy Medical Research Center in Frederick, Maryland, and they found some phages. So we had two cocktails that we were able to use to treat Tom, and luckily we got them in the nick of time.
Dr. Strathy, you and your collaborators were able to find phages that matched up to the bacteria that were making your husband so deathly ill. How did that work in terms of helping him recover?
Well, we had two phage cocktails. One came from Texas A&M University, and one came from the Navy team. And the Texas A&M phages were ready first. And Dr. Chip Schooley and his team in the Division of Infectious Diseases here at UC San Diego put their heads together and consulted some experts. And they said, well, you know, nobody's really done this before in this kind of a way. So why don't we just administer the phages through these catheters in his abdomen that were draining off the infected fluid in his belly to see whether or not he can tolerate it. If he lives through that, then we should go intravenous with the Navy phages because they were deemed to be more potent. And of course, I was terrified. I knew that there was a potential for Tom to die from septic shock because, again, you know, phages are sourced from sewage and you do the best to, you know, spin off all of the debris that you can, but you don't really know how much of this endotoxin, as they call it, needs to be removed. So the first day that we did this was March 15th, 2016. It's seared in my brain. And we injected these phages into the catheters in his abdomen and put a buffer solution, which is basically a salt neutralizing solution, in afterwards because the phages need to be at a neutral pH. And then we clamped off the catheter and kept the phages in close proximity to the infection for about a half an hour and then let that clamp go. And, you know, the first day he seemed, you know, to be pretty stable, but he didn't get any better and he was still in a coma. So 2 days later, when the Navy phages arrived and they were thought to be a much more potent, we injected those into his bloodstream. And that was one of the real innovations of my husband's case because nobody had used phages to treat a systemic bacterial infection going the intravenous route before. And we knew how risky it was, but he was on the verge of multi-system organ failure. His lungs were failing, his heart was failing, and now his kidneys were failing too. And I was told that he was going to need to start kidney dialysis any moment. And so I signed the consent form for that, but we actually never needed the dialysis because he woke up from his coma 2 days later, lifted his head off the pillow, and kissed his daughter's hand.
What a relief.
It was a miracle.
It really was. It really was. And when you have doctors saying this is a miracle, you believe it.
You've been listening to Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, co-director of the UCSD Center of Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics and co-author of a memoir, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Dr. Strathdy is Associate Dean of Global Health Sciences and Harold Simon Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. You'll find a link to her organization in the show notes.
After the break, we'll hear from Lena Zeldovich about using phages as medicine.
She grew up in the former Soviet Union, where phages were common household remedies.
How could phages fight back against antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. CocoVia Cardio Health is offered in both convenient capsule and powder formats, with each serving containing 500 milligrams of cocoa flavanols to support heart health. More information at CocoVia.com.
Today, our topic is overcoming antibiotic-resistant infections. Viruses, called bacteriophages, can fight back against bacteria that have evolved resistance against a wide range of powerful antibiotics. How could we use phages effectively?
Our guest is Lena Zeldovich, journalist, author, and speaker. Lena is the author of The Other Dark Matter, The Science and Business of Turning Waste into Wealth and Health. Her new book is The Living Medicine, How a Life-Saving Cure Was Nearly Lost and Why It Will Rescue Us When Antibiotics Fail.
Welcome to The People's Pharmacy, Lena Zeldovich.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Terry. I'm very excited to be here and talk about phages.
Well, we're really excited to talk about them as well. We've been fascinated with phage therapy for, what, Terry, about 20 or 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
And yet it seems like most people have no clue when you talk about phage therapy, what you're talking about. So let's go right back to the beginning. How did you and, you know, your background in Russia with a family of scientists, how did you get interested in phages?
Well, I had a very unconventional upbringing. I grew up in a family of scientists, and part of my childhood was reading scientific studies, not really understanding what these studies were about. But we just had so many different magazines with so many different weird letters and formulas and names. And you know, being a very curious child, I just read everything I could. Whether I understood it or not was another story. I grew up in Russia, which was, you know, back then was the former Soviet Union. And I learned to read fairly early, somewhere between 4 and 5 years old. And then I just started reading everything. In one of the magazines that I was going through, there was kind of a funny picture of an organism that looked a little bit like a space shuttle or a spaceship. And it was named phage. And in Russian, that spells with a very specific letter that looks like a person standing with, you know, his hands on his hips. And it just looked so interesting that I started reading what the whole thing was about. And as I read, I realized that they were talking about a potential medicine, or maybe they were testing that medicine, and they were particularly testing that medicine against dysentery, something that I was very familiar with because the last couple of years we had summer outbreaks of dysentery because of some contaminated shipment of fruit. And I was very familiar with all this new diarrhea and stomach cramps and this and that. In my case, I was cured with antibiotics, and you couldn't get any antibiotics when I was sick because everybody was sick and pharmacies were out of it. My grandfather had to travel, you know, someplace very far to bring me this box. So I was reading and I was thinking, what if I could drink some of that medicine, some of that weird phage thing? And then I decided that because this character was so potent and so good and so robust, deserve to be looking a little bit better than just dull black and white. So I brought a bunch of my pencils and I colored that whole page in all sorts of colors. That was my first introduction to the phage.
Well, before we go any further, spell phage, because it's not with an F, it's with a PH.
Right. It's in, you know, in English, it spells with a PHAGE.
I think it might be time for us to really explain to our listeners what a phage is and why a phage or a bunch of phages, perhaps, could be helpful in treating something serious like dysentery.
And why you called your book The Living Medicine.
So what a phage is, what phages are, they are viruses that infect bacteria only. They are not harmful to humans. They don't have the right biological equipment to infect human cells. Phages are some of the oldest organisms on Earth, and they've been at this battle with bacteria for millions and millions of years. And the way it works is pretty much like any virus. A phage lands on bacteria, it punctures the bacterial cell wall, it squeezes itself, its little, capsid into the bacterial cells. Inside the cell, it unwraps and it hijacks the cellular machinery to make more copies of itself. And depending on the phage, some make only 10 copies, others make 100, and others make even more. And once they're ready, they pierce the bacterial cells open, bacteria falls apart and dies, and phages come out and proceed to infect other bacteria. The interesting part about phages, it is usually the one-on-one correspondence. So, a particular phage will only infect a particular bacterial strain and leave others intact.
So, Lena, I like to phrase phage therapy as the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And what I guess I mean by that is that here, I think for many, many decades, Americans have thought of viruses as enemies. I mean, we think about influenza. Now we think about COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Ooh, our enemies. Viruses are bad. Viruses kill us. We have to eliminate viruses, but we don't have very many antiviral drugs. We do have some against HIV. We have some against herpes viruses. But the idea that viruses could be our friends, that's kind of a hard to swallow concept for a lot of people. I think even a lot of healthcare providers. Have I got it right that basically what you're saying is phage therapy is our friend?
Yes, you got it right. There are some viruses out there that can be our friends.
Could you tell us a little bit, please, Lena, about how these bacteriophage viruses were discovered? Because for a long time, we didn't know much about them or anything about them.
Absolutely. So phages were discovered a little over 100 years ago in 1917, and they were actually discovered by two people working independently. In the Western world, we tend to hear more about one of them, a French character named Félix Durrell. But there was another person who also accidentally stumbled upon phages in a totally separate part of the world, in Tbilisi, Georgia. And we usually don't hear about this person because for so many years, for 70 years almost, the Western world and the Eastern world was divided by the Iron Curtain and not that much information passed through. So here's how it happened. So Félix Durrell was a French microbiologist working in Pasteur's Institute. And he stumbled upon phages when he was trying to cure people who had dysentery. And in one of the patients, back then dysentery was vicious. This was before antibiotics. A lot of people who contracted it died. And in one of the patients that he was taking care of didn't die. So Durrell looked through this person's stool samples, and he found something that destroyed dysentery germs. He couldn't see it because the microscopes of the time couldn't show him what it was. It took almost to 1930s to have microscopes that were able to see viruses. But he knew he was onto something. So it's 1917, he publishes a paper in one of the leading French journals saying, I found a parasite of microbes. I can't see it, but it's there. I managed to recreate it. it works, the paper goes out.
And by the way, Lena, he called it the invisible microbes. So it was like, I can't see them, but they're killing bacteria. They're the parasite of bacteria, which is kind of a cool concept that his colleagues at the Pasteur Institute couldn't wrap their heads around.
They could not, and it would eventually evolve into this whole other controversy. So meanwhile, in Georgia, there is another person. His name is Georgi Elyava, nicknamed Gogi. He comes from a fairly prominent family. His father was a doctor. He thought about becoming a doctor, but he was feeling so bad about taking money from the sick that he decided it wasn't his calling.
Lena, you have been telling us about Gogi Elyava, who lived in Tbilisi, and he also independently discovered bacteriophage. You really paint a very exciting picture of this character in The Living Medicine. It reads almost like a novel. So please tell us more about Elyava.
Absolutely. So Georgi or Gogi Elyava came from a fairly prominent family. His father was a physician, and for a while Gogi was thinking about becoming a doctor, but he felt so bad about taking money from the sick that he decided he couldn't possibly do it. So he went to study literature, then ended up protesting against the Tsar, being expelled, couldn't go to any Russian university anymore, and his family sent him to study to Geneva University, which at the time was one of the most liberal universities in Europe. So while there, Gogi listened to a lecture about microbiology and was completely and totally taken by the idea of these little creatures that, you know, that can make people sick, and the fact that you can study them and find medicines and find solutions or make vaccines to prevent the diseases. So he comes back to Georgia just when the whole world is near falling apart. Georgia is separating from the Russian Empire. Russians are fighting the Ottomans. He's sent to the Ottoman front to tame the epidemics of new cholera and dysentery, which at the time you could do with vaccines, to become sort of like a hero. And then he comes back to Tbilisi and he continues his research in his lab. So cholera is very much of a concern. So he is studying the samples from the local river, Tkvari, and he definitely sees the cholera vibrance in the samples. And then something happens. He gets called into a meeting or something, you know, something else. He locks the lab. He leaves the samples underneath the microscope, locks the lab and goes away. He comes back 2 days later and he doesn't see any vibrance in the now dried up water. But they should have been there even if the water dried up. So he repeats his experiments again and again, and it happens again and again. The cholera germs disappear. And he doesn't have any explanation for this. He's about 20 years younger than Durrell. He's not as experienced, but it just sticks with him. He just knows he stumbled up on something. It's a very curious person. He doesn't let this go. So Georgia sends him to Paris to work at the Pasteur's Institute to learn as much about medicine as possible. And when he comes to the Pasteur's Institute, he walks into this massive controversy because nobody believes Durrell that he found parasites of microbes that nobody can see. And it sounds so familiar that Elyava goes, wait a second, I've seen that too. So he goes to the institute director and he says, I've seen this. Can I repeat his experiments? And he does. And he proves that that weird disappearance has happened. And even though nobody can explain how it works, it is a scientific phenomena. So from that point on, the two become not just friends, but lifelong collaborators.
And actually, the collaboration leads to medicines that can be used to cure people of terrible bacterial infections. Is that correct?
It is correct. There was a point in time when the two were working very closely on setting up a big center in Tbilisi, a big, you know, phage and medical center in Tbilisi, where they plan to grow phages and use them to treat bacterial infections.
And roughly speaking, Lena, when was that?
1920s, early 1930s.
So here we are in, you know, almost a century ago, and we have in Tbilisi, Georgia, in the Soviet Union, this amazing discovery that bacteriophages, these viruses, might be almost like magic bullets, where they would target a bad bacteria, such as Shigella, for example, and wipe it out with few, if any, side effects. What happened next? Because in theory, this should have been a discovery comparable or even greater than penicillin.
Very good question. So unfortunately, this was a very divided world and genuinely dangerous world. So it's 1920s and 1930s, and these two friends are working together to set up a phage center in Tbilisi, Georgia. Unfortunately, right then and there is when Stalin's purges start happening. And It was such a difficult time for everybody because you didn't have to do anything wrong, but just on mere suspicion, you would be found guilty. And so somehow Elieva fell out of favor with the government. And his methods were questioned, not just questioned. He was being suspect of spying against the Soviet Union, against the Red Army. He was arrested and taken away from his family. His wife was arrested too. Derelle at the time was in France, and he tried to interfere and save his friend, but it didn't work. Just about everything they worked on together was destroyed. Whatever papers were found there were destroyed. And so this method never really, their work never really appeared enough in the Western literature to gain any credibility. At the same time, when antibiotics were discovered, they were so much easier to manufacture and they had a much longer shelf life. They worked consistently. While phages sometimes work and sometimes didn't, and you had to, it was more of a personal medicine concept. You had to adjust the phage to what the person was battling. So basically, it was antibiotics pushed phages out because they were easier, simpler, and perhaps better understood.
You're listening to Lena Zeldovich, journalist, author, and speaker. Lena is the author of The Other Dark Matter, The Science and Business of Turning Waste into Wealth and Health. Her new book is The Living Medicine, How a Life-Saving Cure Was Nearly Lost, and Why It Will Rescue Us When Antibiotics Fail.
When did scientists start to notice antimicrobial resistance? Why haven't we responded more effectively to this threat?
Drug companies and the National Institutes of Health have been slow to support phage research. As a result, American doctors don't know about harnessing bacteriophage therapy.
We'll get an update on the current state of phage research.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Thank you. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements, cocoflavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health, made with a proven concentrated flavanol extract. More information at cocovia.com.
Why have drug companies mostly ignored the potential for bacteriophage therapy in the fight against antibiotic-resistant infections? Could these viral warriors be harnessed to fight the superbugs that no longer respond to our strongest antibiotics?
We're talking with journalist Lena Zeldovich, author of The Living Medicine, How a Life-Saving Cure Was Nearly Lost, and Why It Will Rescue Us When Antibiotics Fail.
What happened after the war? Because by then, and perhaps even after the Soviet Union fell, one would have imagined that phage therapy and research would begin to come into its own. What happened?
Well, after the war, generally, the world was really excited about antibiotics because, again, they were easy to produce. It seemed like we nailed them down. They worked pretty consistently. That's what everybody wanted to use. In the Soviet Union, these two modalities were continued being used together in whatever was available. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart, some of the people familiar with, some of the scientists familiar with phages started coming over to the United States and, to the West and sharing that knowledge. But it was always met with kind of, suspicions and general mistrust for a whole variety of reasons. One of them was just the general, commie medicine. Things coming out of the Soviet Union couldn't be trusted. And there was a whole slew of political reasons why. Nobody in the West was really familiar with the concept anymore. Anyone who used the phages back in the 1920s just generally wasn't around. And the last one was the fact that, wait a second, it's a virus. A virus can't be good.
Mm-hmm. And moreover, it's coming from the former Soviet Union.
Right.
That puts it under suspicion,
right.
too.
Nobody wants commie medicine. I mean, we want Western antibiotics. So the idea didn't take foothold in the United States in the 50s or 60s. When did people start to recognize that phage therapy might offer promise, especially as the microbes began to overcome antibiotics?
Well, I think the very, very early thoughts of that, the first signs of bacteria being able to overcome antibiotics actually started in the 50s and 60s, but there was still a general belief that we can make better antibiotics. By the 80s and 90s, it was becoming more of a concern. And I think the first thoughts that maybe we need an alternative began in 1990s. And it was one of the Georgian scientists who came here with that concept. And in fact, when he heard that American medics have no idea what phages are, he was shocked because in his home country, he grew up drinking these medicines.
Well, so he had grown up in Tbilisi, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He had grown up in Tbilisi and, he grew up using this medicine, and he was absolutely shocked that this wasn't an alternative here.
And it just so happened he was working in the U.S., and as you tell it, in The Living Medicine, and he was so shocked when his mentor and friend came in very dejected that a patient of his had died because of a resistant bacterial infection.
Yes. He was working in the U.S. Together with a very well-known infectious disease physician, Glenn Morris, at the Maryland School of Medicine. And one day when Glenn came to the lab, looking like something horrible happened, Sandra Sulakhvelidze, asked Glenn what happened. And Glenn said, well, one of my patients just died. He was battling an antibiotic-resistant infection, and we couldn't save him. And so Sandra said, wait a second, even bacteriophage didn't help? And Maurice gave him this total blank stare, and Sandra realized that nobody ever heard of phages in the States.
Right. And that's a pretty big oversight.
And so the two started working together to change that, but it took Sandra nearly a quarter of a century to get his first clinical trial approved by the FDA.
And have any bacteriophages been approved by the Food and Drug Administration as of today?
Not for mass use. There have been a lot of cases when they were approved as, you know, like a measure of last resort, as investigational new drug, and with a lot of success. And there are now, as of today, there are many, many clinical trials testing them against all sorts of antibiotic-resistant infections, but we don't have them yet approved, you know, in a sense that you can go to the doctor and ask for a prescription.
Well, that really brings up the question of the world that we live in now, where bacterial resistance is just a fact of life. And there are now superbugs that are resistant to most, if not all, antibiotics. And when that happens, we don't have a magic pill that we can pull out of a bag and say, aha, here is the solution. So
we need a plan B.
We need plan B. And here we have bacteriophages that go back over 100 years that might be plan B. And I guess I'm curious first if you have any idea why the pharmaceutical industry hasn't embraced bacteriophage research, or why the National Institutes of Health haven't said, oh, this is the greatest, we need to explore this, or why the rest of the world hasn't followed in the footsteps of the researchers in Georgia that came up with the concept so very long ago, and why hasn't the FDA encouraged this? So why don't we have plan B ready to go as we have the challenge of all of these superbugs?
Right. That is a great question. And kind of like, you know, stealing my own thunders, I should say that at this point, the agencies are working on Plan B, but it took a long, long time to get there. And there were some valid reasons why it took us so long to get there. So phages are trickier to grow because you can't synthesize them in, you know, in big machines with consistently with the same amounts and the same time and whatever. Because phages are viruses, they occupy kind of that liminal space between living organisms and not living organisms. But they have their own sort of like finicky taste. Sometimes they grow well, sometimes they don't grow well. Even if they grew well yesterday, they may not do as well today. You have a slightly different strain of bacteria. The same phage may take some time to adapt to infect this bacteria as efficiently as, you know, the previous strain. So they were always a little bit unpredictable, and predictability is one thing that mass medicines need. And that tended to be a concern for the FDA also, because traditional medicines don't alter their molecular formula or structure from one batch to the next. And the active ingredients in amoxicillin and Cipro are defined, quantified, clinically tested, and they have that FDA approval stamp. And even with dosage, you know, you give somebody an antibiotic, you know exactly what dose to give. You give somebody a phage, you don't know what these phages are going to do in their stomach. They may multiply at the expense of bacteria. Well, they may not. So how much fudge do you give? It could really be very tricky.
But we have bacteriophages in our bodies right now. As we're talking, bacteriophages are everywhere.
Absolutely so. Which, it's, you know, it's a very good question why we sort of haven't jumped on it earlier. I guess maybe the thought was always that we'll just invent another antibiotic. The other thing is phages, when you really dealing with a severe antibiotic resistant infection, you have to use this person's sample to grow your phage, which is exactly what happened to Stephanie's husband. And it's also not necessarily an easy thing, right? You have to go and find them, or you have to have a library, which is, by the way, what the Navy was doing, which is how it should be done. And the other thing is that bacteria that exist out there in the world, they evolve, right? So it is entirely possible that you may have a patient with a bacteria that all your phages are not active against. So you'd have to go and find a new phage or grow a new phage or train this phage to attack this bacteria. So it's a lot of work and you don't know how much money you're going to make. So I think that was one reason why phages were stepchildren for pharmaceutical industry for so long.
You just mentioned that bacteria evolve, which is how they become resistant to antibiotics. They can also evolve resistance to phages, but do the phages evolve along with the bacteria, or?
Absolutely.
How can we overcome that problem?
Absolutely. Phages and bacteria evolved alongside each other for millions of years, and this is just what they do. Bacteria can evolve resistant to a phage, but the phage will evolve to attack this bacteria better. That's why they're still around. And that's something that antibiotics can do. They are set molecules that can change themselves. We have to do it, and it's very expensive and long process. With phages, if you do this right, you can train a phage to attack bacteria better, and Durrell did this, and even back then, 100 years ago. Or you can also go out in the world and look for a new phage. And there are trillions of phages in nature. So as one person who I interviewed for the book, Carl Merrill, told me, we'll never run out of them.
And I'm assuming that we are not vulnerable to these viruses, that these enemies of bacteria are not our enemies. They're our friends.
They're not our enemies. They are friends.
Lena, can you tell us what the current state of research is? You've described that essentially to treat a patient with an infection, you really have to do what amounts to personalized medicine. The phage cocktail needs to be tailored exactly for that person and that person's infectious bacteria.
So a lot of cases where doctors would go to the FDA and ask for this investigational new drugs permission were like that. They would have a patient who have an infection that wasn't responding to antibiotics, and they needed sort of like this specialty treatment to save them. It doesn't always have to be like that. So in Georgia, they have six different cocktails that they use to kind of like off-the-shelf product that you can go and buy in any pharmacy. And when I was there, I went and bought them just because I didn't need them, but it was kind of cool to hold this box in my hand and read the labels. And so they are, there's some that are you drink when you have a stomach upset, and they like targeting like things like Shigella, Listeria, and Salmonella, and others you gurgle with when you have a throat infection, and you can just walk and buy them. However, you have to keep in mind that some of these phages may eventually lose their activity against certain bacteria. So scientists at the Eliava Institute constantly check them whether they're still active against various bacteria samples. It's an ongoing process and you can't stop. And I think that's what maybe we haven't realized here in the West, that we can't really stop. We'll never be able to stop because bacteria evolve. It's just easier to have like an arsenal of phages that you can constantly check against the samples that you keep collecting.
Lena Zeldovich, what does your crystal ball reveal? What does the future look like for bacteriophage therapy?
That is a great question. I wish I actually did have this crystal ball. From what I found is right now, there's sort of like an explosion of all things phage research. You know, from the moment I started putting this book together up until now, so many new things developed. And it's really good to see that there is so much interest and so much potential. I think countries with lower income are very excited about this because it can be a cheaper way of making medicines, especially if you don't expect to have a lot of profit in return. How it's going to go in the Western medicine, I hope that we get to the point when some of these medicines are approved. Because we need them desperately and we need them yesterday. And the prognosis is really, really grim. When you look at what, you know, UN is saying, WHO is saying, we might be heading into a bacterial pandemic that can be a lot worse than COVID.
Lena Zeldovich, thank you so much for writing The Living Medicine and for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Lena Zeldovich, author of The Other Dark Matter, The Science and Business of Turning Waste into Wealth and Health. Her new book is The Living Medicine, How a Life-Saving Cure Was Nearly Lost and Why It Will Rescue Us When Antibiotics Fail.
We spoke earlier with Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, co-director of the UCSD Center of Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics, and co-author of a memoir, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Dr. Strathdy is Associate Dean of Global Health Sciences and Harold Simon Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. There's a link to her organization in the show notes.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. BJ Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with The People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. CocoVia Memory Plus is formulated with 750 milligrams of cocoa flavanols, a level clinically proven to improve three different types of memory and support brain function. More information at CocoVia.com.
Today's show is number 1,407. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider, including YouTube Music. This week, the podcast has additional information from both our guests. You can find out about Russian soldiers using phages during World War II and what medical students are learning about phage kits now. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter and get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also get regular access to information about our weekly podcast. Find out ahead of time what topics we're covering.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you so much for listening. Please join us again next week.